The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So, joining us today on The Parents Show, we have in the studio Lucy Mortimer from Mindful Space. So, welcome to The Parents Show, Lucy.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. So I think, first of all, we need to know what mindfulness is and what mindful space is all about. So maybe you could just begin by telling our listeners about yourself and your background and how you came to run your own mindfulness business.
Sure. So yes. So I live in Harpenden and I was a class teacher for about 20 years. And then I stopped for a while to bring up my three children. And whilst I had stopped teaching for a while, I took up some tutoring in maths and preparation for SATs in year six. And my degree was in education and music, so I used to tutor in piano. And I started to notice that a lot of the children who were coming through my door were suffering from anxiety.
Yes.
And a lot of the parents who were bringing their children through my door were also suffering from anxiety in one way or another, whether it was leading up to a piano exam or a maths test or the SATs. So I kind of wanted to focus on helping this aspect of mental health in education. So I researched what was being done about this. And I came across a charity called the Mindfulness in Schools Project.
Mm-hmm.
So I trained with them, and I was actually the first person in the whole of the southeast of England to run a pilot study at a school in Harpenden to try out this new theory. So I was doing that part-time alongside my teaching. And then a couple of years ago, I finally resigned from the classroom as a class teacher to fully focus on my company, Mindful Space.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So which school was that in Harpenden?
It was St. Nicholas School.
Oh, St. Nicholas School. That's the church school in Harpenden.
It is.
And that's a primary school, isn't it?
Yes.
In Harpenden. Lovely small school, I think.
Yeah, really lovely. And they were so open to me coming in, and, you know, they really value mental health. So it was a great starting point.
Yeah. So I guess that was the particular moment, the event that sparked the idea of taking mindfulness into schools. So do you do a lot of work with schools now, or is it a broad variety of different organisations that you go and help?
Yeah, so I do still work a lot in schools. I work in a school in Hemel. I've worked in quite a few schools within Harpenden. I work at secondary schools as well. So it's kind of across the board, really, within Hertfordshire itself. And I also take workshops into the workplace. So I work with adults to help them with their anxiety at work.
Yeah. And is your experience that it's the same collection of issues that affects people at different ages? Or would you say that there are particular issues for children and younger people, older people, different issues if people are in a work as opposed to education environment? What would you say about that?
I think, well, when it comes to children, I think so many children have this sense of trying to keep up with their friends, comparing themselves to others in the way they look and in their work. And this is kind of across the board with all ages. I think overstimulation from social media plays a huge part. Especially with things like, you know, every time your phone beeps, it kickstarts a chemical in your body that kind of is a feel-good factor. So you start to take on this sense of, oh, I just want instant gratification for things.
Is that a fact? So there's a kind of physiological reaction when your phone goes beep. I mean,
yeah. And if this is happening from a very early age, then, you know, our bodies sort of start to want this feeling, this instant gratification. Unfortunately, life isn't that easy. And a lot of things we do have to work for. And, you know, if we want to get good at anything, whatever our age, we need perseverance. We need to build resilience. You know, I'm kind of at the age now that if I wanted a free book, I had to walk to a library to get one. And if I went on holiday to Greece, I had to wait in the queue of Boots to get my photos developed, had to wait up to 10 days. And then I had to remember to take my ticket with me. So I think children's brains are actually structurally developing differently nowadays because of the experiences they're having. And science is showing us this.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what happens when you're working in a school. What might a typical day look like for you if you go to one of the schools that you work with and do some work there?
So if I'm in a primary school, I always work very closely with the head teacher and with senior leadership. So when I walk in, I might often give a whole school assembly on mental health, an aspect of mental health, usually mindfulness. I would have one-to-one sessions with some of the children who we've earmarked as needing extra support. I'd work with small groups. At the moment, I've got a small group running of different age children in the primary school who are all young carers. So we talk about the issues surrounding that. I run whole class sessions. I run one-to-one sessions with staff at lunchtime and after school. So I kind of work with a whole school community. I'm a great believer in this triangle of child, parent, and teacher all working together. I run Kappa mornings for parents at drop-off, and I run inset days for staff. So yes, it's across the board within schools. And then with secondary schools, I work alongside pastoral. I run 9-week programs that were developed by the Mindfulness in Schools project. And that I also run my own exam preparation course leading up to GCSEs and A-levels. So yeah, it's busy.
Yes. So well, there's lots that we can unpack there. But I'm just wondering, while you're talking about that, how welcoming schools and perhaps businesses as well, but thinking particularly about schools, how welcoming teachers are of the idea of mindfulness being relevant to them and to their students. So do you find that generally speaking, people welcome you in with open arms, or is it possible that sometimes people are a bit skeptical about this mindfulness stuff?
Yeah, I think what I have is a complete understanding of what teachers go through, because I was one myself. I have a complete understanding of what parents go through, because I am one. You know, I have a complete understanding of what the child goes through, because I used to be one. So I kind of understand where they're coming from. I do get the odd teacher who thinks, how on earth am I going to fit that into my curriculum, which I totally get. But within one session of me having their class and them sitting in watching, they understand just how important it is, you know, for the child to be able to feel steady in their seat.
Yeah.
To allow their child to be able to focus better with their work. And these are all the elements of mindfulness that I bring into the classroom. So if that's all in place, then they're able to focus better and results improve as a result. And the same in the workplace. You know, if I'm going into a workplace to deliver some seminars or small group workshops, they can very quickly see the benefit of what I'm doing. And it helps in so many ways with their relationships with colleagues, the way they communicate to others, understanding their own thought patterns and how that's reflected in the way they present themselves, all leading to greater productivity.
Yeah. And do you have any kind of evidence for the improvement? I mean, have people even anecdotally fed back to you in schools that what you've been able to contribute has actually helped them and some of the pupils do better?
Yes, definitely. And I totally understand that a lot of schools want to see that almost before they employ me. So, yeah, I always do a before and after. I do a report with each school that I work at. I also have ongoing feedback from students that I present to heads. Yeah, all demonstrating the benefits of how the children are feeling about life in general. So the strategies I teach them, it's important that they're applying them across the board, not just for that 1 hour in that classroom when they feel all nice and relaxed and calm and in control. It's about using those strategies in whatever situation they find themselves in. So it could be something happening at home, you know, an annoying brother or sister. It could be reactivity on the sports pitch. It could be that complete blind panic in the exam. And there is evidence, yes, that I get back from a lot of those students. And sometimes it's nice if I've had a student say in year six that I teach the actual program to, the Mindfulness in Schools project to, and then I see them a few years later when I'm running my exam preparation course with them, And they say to me, oh, I used your Fofbok, which is feet on floor, bottom on chair strategy, one of the strategies we use. I used your Fofbok in my SATs and it really helped. And, you know, I had to give a presentation and I remembered your finger breathing you taught me. So, you know, these are life skills that I'm teaching that are with them literally for life.
So I'm going to ask you about Fofbok and some of the other things in a minute because I can't let that pass. But I'm guessing from what you're saying that your involvement with the school would be over a period. So it wouldn't just be a one day visit. I'm imagining that you might work with a school over a longer period. Is that right? What would be typical?
Yeah. So what I often do is I'd speak at head teacher conferences. So I have, you know, all the heads in decorum in one room, and I talk through my presentation and I say to them, use me as you see fit for your school. Every school is different and every school has different needs. So it could be, you know, there's one school, primary school I work at, that I go into once a term and I run a whole day of workshops and I get through every single class. And then I might run a twilight session for the staff as part of a staff meeting. And that's how they want me. That drip feed once a month, right through to a school that I work in a full day every week from 7:30 to 4 p.m. And I get through all classes. I have my one-to-ones. I have small groups. So it very much depends on the school. A lot of secondary schools like me in to run a 9-week program. They also like me in for the exam prep leading up to exams where you can see the fear in the students' eyes and teaching them skills for that. So it's very specific to the school.
Okay, we have to get back to Fofbok because I want to know how you get particularly very young children to sit still and practice mindfulness, because it strikes me that that must be a job in three quarters. So how do you do it?
Well, yeah, I mean, so I guess the youngest age that I would work with is probably around 6 years of age. And the sitting still bit is only a really small part of this mindfulness. It's all about making mindfulness relevant to them. So a typical session with them might be talking about what kind of day they're having and how these experiences are having in this moment are feeling for them. So it might say, I got star of the week and it made me feel really happy. And then we start to drill down into the emotive vocab. What does happy feel like? How do you feel happy in your body? And, you know, having this kind of link between our mind and our body is what is so important for mindfulness, rather than those numb moments, you know, when you try and get to sleep at night and your body's exhausted, but your mind is just wired and you can't get to sleep and all the thoughts are going around your head. So from a very early age, just trying to embed this idea that our mind is related to our body, very closely linked. And there's a lovely quote, our body hears what our mind says. So if our body's feeling stressed, our mind will then get stressed and anxious. So mindfulness is about steadying the physical self, and then our thoughts will start to settle.
Mm-hmm. So, but back to Fofbok, without wanting to sort of focus too much on that. What is that again?
So this is from the Mindfulness in Schools project, one of my sessions I do with them. Fofbok, it stands for feet on floor, bottom on chair. And this is a formal mindfulness practice, which means you have to sit in a certain way. A lot of mindfulness is informal, so you can practice it as you're walking between lessons, as you're in the lunch hall, wherever. But a Fofbok is very much having your feet flat on the floor and then imagining, we talk about a torch beam of awareness. And our torch beam is very often up in our heads, getting all mixed up with our thoughts and our emotions. And it can get quite loud and buzzy up in our heads. So we learn how to drop this torch beam of awareness down our body, away from our busy mind, and we can choose to set the torch beam down in our feet, to settle the beam there, and start to understand how our feet are feeling right now, how steady they feel, how heavy they feel, and then you gradually bring that torch beam up the lower half of the body, step by step, feeling anchored in your seat.
Wow. I'm already feeling calmer, actually, just hearing you talking about that. I can see how that would be working with small children. Do you do something different with tweenagers and teenagers? Because you were saying right at the beginning that obviously mobile phones and those are pretty universal now among that demographic.
Yeah.
So what do you do for teenagers to help them with those distractions?
So I wouldn't, so with the very young children, I often use my famous Ollie the Owl as well. So a visual resource is good for them. When they are slightly older, I just have, I believe that children are taught so much in school. You know, I mean, the amount of information they have to retain up to GCSE is just horrific. But that, I'll save that gripe for another day. But they're not very often taught much about their own brain and about their own mind. So as soon as I say this to kids, they are already quite hooked because they want to be able to use their brain as well as they can, you know, so they're not that drilled in class being told to pay attention and get on with their work.
Yeah.
So they jump on board quite quickly with it. And it's with teenagers that the 9-week Mindfulness in Schools project is really useful because it's a structured program. We cover things like how to be mindful in sport, how to be mindful in music, how to be mindful with performance, with tests. And every teenager has had to deal with something uncomfortable within school, whether it's standing up in front of the class or, you know, whatever it is. So we learn a lot of strategies to help themselves in these kinds of situations that are very relevant to their own lives.
Amazing. And so let's talk some more about exams, because you mentioned those in passing, and we've talked about exams a little bit earlier as being one of the major stress inducers for kids. Well, actually, for anybody really, I think myself included, I've always hated exams. And as you say, you can see the fear in people's eyes when exam time is coming around and teachers starting to talk about what they need to do for revision and so on.
Yeah.
So what about those exam years? And exams are coming up, obviously, for many people, different times of year. What tips would you give for children, teachers, and parents, if there's worry about exams, what could they try to do?
Okay, so I would say that any students out there, your teachers are on your side. They want you to do well. And exams are a chance to show off what you know. They're not out there to try and trip you up. And in fact, the whole reason I went into this mindfulness was based around... I was just getting so upset that I was seeing these teenagers get up for school every day of their lives, get dressed, get into school at the right time, sit through all the lessons. And then when it came to the crunch, they just completely crumbled, purely because of the anxiety. So, my tips would be to students, try and remain present, you know, try not to keep jumping ahead. I demonstrate with 3 water bottles, and the first bottle signifies the past, the second water bottle signifies the present, the third bottle signifies the future. And if you're trying to hold all 3 water bottles up, it's going to get heavy, you know? You're worrying about the fact you haven't revised for that exam. Well, that's in the past. You can't do anything about that now. So put that down. Try not to do the what ifs. What if I run out of the exam feeling sick? What if I haven't done enough to get into university? That's not here yet. So put that water bottle down. Just hold on to this present water bottle, because actually the only thing we have full control of is this moment.
Lovely.
So a lot of students, you know, we are, and adults as well in the workplace, you're grappling. It's very unsettling having these 3 bottles you're trying to hold on to and get heavier and heavier.
Yeah.
So just park what you can. If you can focus on this moment, this is the moment that counts. And in this moment, we can learn so many strategies to help us feel steadier in our body so that our mind can then settle.
I think that sounds like fabulous advice. And while you were talking there, Lucy, I was thinking about, you know, myself many years ago, trying to stay focused as exam time approached and having difficulty with that. And I know that there are lots of people now who have particularly difficulty with that. And I'm thinking about some kids who are maybe further along the neurodivergent continuum than others, have different and maybe even combinations of reasons why it's more difficult for them to be mindful in the way that you're describing. So I'm wondering if you ever get to a point with a young person where actually it needs more support and really the thing is just too big for them.
Sure, definitely. I think it's really important to understand that mindfulness isn't a therapy. So I'm not a therapist. What I'm coming in to do is to teach children and adults these life skills. I often do refer students to external services through the schools that I work at if I feel they've got things happening which I feel are out of my own remit. Unfortunately, in schools, there's so much funding which has been pulled that there's a lot of pressure on the teachers to deal with this a huge array of mental health challenges. So what I'm doing is hopefully, I mean, it's inclusive, it's for everyone. I like to think that what I'm putting in place are some preventative strategies, but there certainly are a lot of children who, you know, are coming through with ADHD and ADD who we do signpost elsewhere, but they still enjoy my sessions. You know, they still are able to tune in to their own thoughts and feelings and physical sensations.
And is it your experience that you can link in with maybe special educational needs teachers and the schools to redirect children that you've discovered need a bit more help to the right places? Do you find that schools are equipped to do that?
I'd like to say they are very equipped. But as I said, the budgets are, you know, just really being pulled on it. I mean, my role within school is very much of... I work with the senior leadership teams and I would flag up children who often, usually they're flagged up anyway, who they then would signpost elsewhere for extra support.
Yeah. And what about parents and their role in this? I mean, do you find that parents are able to cope with children when maybe their child is somewhere along that spectrum there? What can parents do generally to support their children's mental health?
Well, I mean, where to start? How long have you got? I think across the board, I've got loads of, you know, everyone has advice for parents, don't they? But I believe that you should teach young children to handle books as much as they know about handling phones. You know, I see toddlers often in prams just swiping and scrolling through phones, and I'm thinking, my goodness me. I think parents, it's important that we role model the right kind of behaviours. So if your child is talking to you about something, then look at them, give them eye contact. Don't be half on your phone. Acknowledge your children's feelings, whatever their age. Don't be too quick to jump in and react. You know, sometimes children don't want answers. They just want someone there to listen. I also believe it's important that parents have faith in the school that they've sent their child to. So if parents have been lucky enough to be able to choose the school that they want, then please support the teachers who work there. You know, remember, we're all in this together, the parent, the child and the teacher. If your child is having an all-out tantrum, I'm afraid the bad news is that right in that moment, there's very little you can do. You know, the front part of their brain, their prefrontal cortex is being flooded with adrenaline and cortisol, what we call brain hijacking. So the part of our brain responsible for focus and making the right choices isn't actually working in that moment. And it can take up to 20 minutes for the prefrontal cortex to then re-engage with choices and thinking about what they've done. So give them space as long as they're safe. And then it's at that point, a little bit later on, that you can talk things through. And also think about how you mirror stuff with your child. So in the way you speak with them, in your body, if your child is really kicking off and shouting at you, try to de-escalate it by consciously lowering your voice, slowing your voice down. And if you're able to do that, you're not fueling the situation even more. You're not kind of rising up with them. And you will notice that they can't keep going up. They will end up slowing down themselves. It might seem forever, but that's another tip I have.
I'm sure those are all great tips. And just speaking as a parent myself, I know that it's actually quite difficult for parents to keep their heads
absolutely
in those moments. So it's not just sometimes, it's not just the child's prefrontal cortex that's I think a lot of parents could be forgiven for getting into that condition themselves. So
completely.
What do you think is good advice for parents
in
those moments and generally trying to look after their own mindfulness and mental health?
Yeah, I think we're so busy as parents, aren't we? And, you know, schools teach in PSHE lessons about kindness, being kind to yourself as well as being kind to others. And it's not a luxury for us parents to be kind to ourselves, just to try and give ourselves that moment in our day to be here for us. Parents as well, we're juggling so much. We often jump into the past, jump ahead into the future. The founder of mindfulness has a lovely quote: you can't stop the waves, but you can learn how to surf. So you can't stop the roller coaster of our day-to-day living, but we can learn ways in which to ground ourselves. I mean, another little breathing exercise that I do with adults as well as children is 7-11 breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of this is that you breathe in for a count of 7 and then breathe out for a count of 11. And you get into this kind of rhythmic pattern. And our brains love the rhythm of life. You know, we like our heart beating steadily. We like the flow of our breath. And wherever we are, we've got our breath with us. So I have little things like if I'm driving to work and I come across a red traffic light and I have to stop, that is my sign. Pause. 7-11s. It's nothing I can do about the traffic light. You know, I need to wait for it to turn green. I might as well use that time just to steady myself because I'm jumping ahead. What if I'm late for work? What if? If you're in the office and you're printing off 100 copies on the photocopier, very dull, in that dull moment, pause, 7-11s. And you start kind of anchoring your days by these little portable mindful moments that don't look weird. You know, no one knows that you're practicing your mindfulness, but for you, it's very, very steadying.
Wow. Lucy, that's all fantastic. And there's so much more that we could be talking about. And we don't have time to talk about it all. So if people want to find out more for themselves, if people want to find out more about Mindful Space, what's the best way to get in touch with you? What's the best way to find out more about what you can do?
Yeah, that would be lovely. So my website is www.mindfulspace.me. And you can contact me through contact@mindfulspace.me.
Fantastic. Well, Lucy, that's been really fascinating and encouraging, I think, for everybody listening, struggling with all of the issues that you've been describing. So, Lucy Mortimer, thanks so much for joining us here on The Parents Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to take a little break on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. We'll be back with more chat in just a few minutes. So stay tuned.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome back to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. It's great to have you with us again.
I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and I'm delighted to be joined by our regular contributor, presenter, Karen Hannan, here on The Parents Show this evening. Karen, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show.
Oh, always a pleasure. Always lovely to spend time with you, Lydia.
You too, Karen. I love chatting to you. I love learning from you every time we have a conversation. You know, you switch lights on in my brain that were never going to be switched on, I think. And in particular, obviously, around special educational needs and our neurodivergent community. So we have had a series of fantastic conversations with you about the elevated risk of young people with neurodivergence when it comes to coercive control. I have to say that was a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot, and I'm sure it's really helpful for parents who are listening in. So we talked about the elevated risk. We definitely talked about the impact of it, and it's something we need to all pay attention to. Now, what we'd like to dial down on is what parents can proactively do about this elevated risk in young people.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few things they can do. I think the first thing would be to get some good education, or you know, do some good learning around whichever kind of neurodivergence, which, you know, the child is you know, is their experience of life. And I'll just talk about autism today, but we can think about, you know, you can transfer this kind of thinking across to other neurodivergences as well. And that is that often, and we actually just recently had a conversation about looking at the different models of neurodivergence and why they're important. So I'm going to touch slightly on that right now. And then we're going to go into that in more detail in another session. But we have to, number one, help parents and young people move away from this kind of doom negative narrative around, let's say, autism, for instance. And we have to find ways to help the child and the young person and the family to embrace this identity and to feel positive about it and to see potential and have aspirations for the child, rather than the very negative worries that parents may have and the concerns that children and young people may have about being different that is more prominent, because the dominant model in our society is what is called the medical or deficit model. And the narrative around that is very doom laden. And it cites very specifically this way of being, let's say, autistic, for instance, as being a negative and as being problematic. And people are, you know, naturally woke to catastrophize about it, either about themselves or their children, because people worry about themselves and they also worry a lot about their children. And so inevitably, it takes on this sort of very negative beast of a, you know, of thinking around it that really can be a barrier to a child having positive life experiences and life outcomes, and the same for families. And usually it's rooted in a lack of understanding that has been taught to, you know, it's a learned behavior. So what I would say is it's a good idea to, number one, educate yourself about other ways of thinking about autism, right? And also why that's important. And people can tune into the other sessions to understand what they might be, those models that will help. The one I like to focus on is the empowerment and affirmative models. But so it starts with, the difficulty starts with this negative notions around being autistic, for instance. And those negative messages are absorbed by the child subliminally, whether they're direct comments, whether it's the parents' worries. And this is all done unwittingly, often parents, and I, you know, I was one of those parents, are making mistakes because they just don't understand what the impact is of this kind of level of worry that we might have. Okay. So what happens is the child or the young person and the families grow up feeling incredibly isolated, incredibly misunderstood. This way of being, let's say autism, is, you know, is positioned as being incredibly problematic, and therefore that's the narrative and the self-stigma that the child begins to grow up with. So the first thing we can do is educate ourselves about the positives of being neurodivergent, so that we can send those messages to our child. We can help our child begin to understand their strengths. We can help our child understand the richness of the neurodivergent community they belong to. We can help our child recognize the contributions they're going to make positively to society. We can begin to educate ourselves about positive role models for our child. So, for instance, if our child loves a particular sport, let's take swimming. So Michael Phelps, I'm showing my age here. I'm sure there are other swimmers now, but he is he's an ADHD young man. And his prowess and his success came from the drive that came from being ADHD. And the focus, that hyper-focus that comes with it when you are playing to your strengths. So there's something about understanding that our children are different and we as neurodivergent people are different. That doesn't mean we don't have huge value. And we need to send those messages to our children that you are valued, you are lovable, you are worthwhile, you have a right to be proud of yourself, we are proud of you, rather than the sort of worry undertone that sometimes goes with it. So that's what I would say, number one. And I think the other thing is then once you know that, is to move from that knowledge and approach, think about a sort of idea of radical acceptance. So where you accept this child for who they are, and when you get all the naysayers, and sometimes that can come from within your own families, again, because people want the best for the child and they misunderstand how to do that, you're probably going to get an awful lot of advice about maybe what the child should do differently to be less autistic, perhaps, in the eyes of others. But actually, all that is saying to the child is there's something, we're not going to accept you as you are. We want you to be a different person. So we have to start with this notion of radical acceptance of who this child is. We have to understand that this child is always, they came out of the womb like this. They're always going to be like this. And they have great value. And we need to focus on, well, how do we help the child create the value and live up to the value and feel and develop self-esteem and self-worth and those senses of self that are so healthy? And that of itself, because we are creating young people who are proud, who have very positive self-image, who, and you know, we're helping them connect with like-minded people through clubs, like if we take Michael Phelps and his swimming, we're reducing the risks. We're reducing the things that make them more at risk of coercive relationships. So I think we start with something like that.
I love the idea of radical acceptance, Karen. And it seems like such a simple idea. And actually, it probably is, but it's a game changer, isn't it? In the kind of life outcomes of a child, just for a parent or a school or a friend to just go, you're grand the way you are. There's nothing wrong with you. You know, it's so affirming and it's so empowering.
You can move even further than that and say, not only are you good as you are, but we need you. The things you can do, the insights you have, the visions that you can have, and that, you know, the fearlessness you might have, and that directness that you have, and all of those things, actually, we need that, because otherwise society stagnates and goes bad. Yeah. Right.
Oh, absolutely. So the kind of the models around diagnosis, it seems to me, are heavily flawed. And we could really do with the direction change in this. Do you see that happening anytime soon, Karen? Is there hope on the horizon that more positive models will be coming in to diagnosis?
Oh, 100%. There is a strong movement towards affirmation or affirmative-based diagnosis, because the process of diagnosis itself, as it currently is, number one, you have to go through mental health services. So that of itself implies there's something wrong with this way of being, whatever the way of being is. And also, it is very clinical, and the language is very negative about deficits, delays, deficiencies, inabilities, treatments, cures. Okay. But there is a swing over now, and there's a team of professionals, actually, I think from Ireland started it off, really, it kind of came from, of this affirmative base, where when the diagnostic process is happening and the parent or the person is having those conversations with the person doing the assessment, it's a strengths-based approach. So the reports are written in terms of what the strengths are of this person, what kind of different approaches they may need to remove the barriers they face that are placed in front of them, you know, what creates success for them in communication and around their sensory experience of the world. So it affirms the autistic, let's say autistic way of being. It affirms this with very positive language, and it places the responsibility for success on other people understanding this person's autism, because every diagnosis and report's different. And it places and it gives other people and the person tools to reduce the levels of discrimination and the barriers they face to success, rather than saying this person has needs, which seems to imply that the person is lacking in something, when the reality is, it is the environment that is lacking. The environment has created barriers because it suits most people, but it actively works against the autistic, let's say, person. And when we move across to that affirmative model and we say, this is how you say you experience life, we agree this aligns with the notion of being autistic. This is how you've expressed the barriers you face. This is what you have said helps you. These are also our other suggestions about what can help you to have a fairer experience of life and to help you to succeed. And so it gives the person a tool to advocate as well for themselves. So already you're not, you know, if you talk about a person in terms of deficits and impairments and needs, and this notion that there's something wrong with a person, of course, the person's going to grow up with very poor self-esteem, with a very poor sense of self-worth, with very poor self-identity. But if you switch over to a model that is much more affirmative and empowering, and you promote the strengths and you recognize and reward effort and ability for that person, they grow up proud of who they are. They grow up proud of their community. They grow up believing they can achieve. And they don't need the affirmation of other people who might seek to manipulate them. Just because the person has, you know, under the medical model, what happens is you're so desperate to belong because you feel like you belong nowhere that you're rife to be manipulated by others that see that vulnerability in you. Whereas if you bring your young person up and you look at that model and you teach them to say no, and by the way, as I've had to learn, that has to apply to the parent too. So I have to be prepared for my child to say no to me and to refuse, because I want them to be able to say no to people that might be trying to get them to do something that's not very good for them. So that's the beauty of those models, those empowerments and affirmative models, is we are skilling our young people with really important risk-reductive life skills.
So if a parent's listening in and you're a divergent child, if they haven't been diagnosed, do they have the option to go for a more constructive, positive diagnosis process?
That neuroaffirmative approach, if you like. At the moment, I'm not sure that's the usual model through the NHS at the moment.
Yeah.
So it may be, you know, that it's... But what you can do, there is a book that I can't remember the name of. It's called the Adult Assessment Model, I think. And next time when we speak, you can ask me and I'll tell you. I'll have looked it up, the link for that by then. But it's a handbook for clinicians to begin to understand this affirmative model. So what you can do is just get a copy of the book. There's probably lots of stuff by now on the internet about the affirmative approach to assessment. So you can begin to use that language yourself. And also you can do things like provide your child with really positive role models of their neurodivergence, whatever your child's is. So you might look up really successful autistic people. So let's take Billie Eilish, right? I mean, the autism, the neurodivergent brain and creativity and art, I mean, we are one and the same. Not going to lie, right? We wouldn't have music if we didn't have neurodivergence. We wouldn't have great actors, you know, and also think about those other qualities. You know, if you think about lawyers and you think about litigators, you want someone who can be very direct and not worry too much, you know, that they're getting their point across and they are focused on whatever the outcome is. You know, these are talents that our children have, not things we should worry about. So that's what I would say is you can have a look at that book and we'll as I've said, we'll maybe do it. We'll talk more about it in other sessions.
Great. And anything else parents can do to mitigate the risk of their child or their children's vulnerability being exploited by people who kind of use coercion to control?
Yeah. So what I would say is, like we've just said, you know, if you start from that notion of radical acceptance and you think about, well, what's that structure that you're going to provide for your child or help them to begin to learn to provide for themselves? It's going to provide a structural safety net, if you like. So I know that there is, for children who like gaming, for instance, there is a platform called Spectrum Gaming. You can Google it, run by a young man called Andy Smith. And I believe he started it in the lockdown as a way to, because he'd noticed this risk within, you know, children who were on the internet all the time. Of course, we don't always know who they're speaking to, but this is actually, he runs this platform and young people can sign up and they're with other neurodivergent people. And there are, I don't know what you call it, administrators or whatever, but there's some of oversight within it. So it's a really good thing. And he has loads of resources on his page. So I think if you like gaming, then have a look at that. I think what you can do is notice your child's strengths, like I've said, and you can begin to build up their own self-identity and self-esteem. I think you can find maybe ways for them to connect with other people who have the same interests as them. So if your child is particularly techie, you might enroll them into sort of computing clubs or, you know, that kind of thing. If they like drama and makeup and you know, those sort of creative elements, you might enroll them in a few clubs like that. you know, our older teens, we might help them to learn how to run a small business, you know, that they can maybe sell their stuff on Etsy, right? And the other thing I would say is, very often, I think as parents, and I absolutely am guilty of this, and even now, you know, my kids are now 21 almost and 24 nearly, I still veer, as we all do sometimes, towards correction as opposed to connection with my child. And I think particularly as they are moving into the teendom, particularly if it's our first child, so we've not been through that roller coaster already, you know, it's very hard for us as parents sometimes to learn to let go and let them make those mistakes, because we don't want, you know, we want them to be safe and happy, but actually they've got to make mistakes. That's all part of growing up, right? But it's how do we make ourselves available at those times when they really need to come to us because there's something going on that doesn't feel good for them? So it might be just have a regular popcorn night on a Friday night. It might be that, you know, rather that, you know, the word should is an incredibly shaming word, isn't it, Lydia? And I know my reaction when I hear it when someone's talking to me. So I'm not sure why I think my children should respond differently, ironically. But so I think it's more about maybe using language that notices stuff. So rather than saying, oh, you know, things like, you know, you're in your room all the time, you'll never get off the computer, and you don't talk to me. It might be things like, I've noticed you seem much quieter than usual. Is that so? We need to make ourselves available. Obviously, we correct, you know, certain things. So if they do something ridiculous, like pick up the car keys and they don't have a driving license, then we take the keys off them and don't let them get in the car. But I think if it's just that they've got to, you know, they've told you, I was telling someone this the other day. I remember when I worked in hotels years ago, and I remember this time in particular, I went home talking to my dad about this situation, and hotels are crazy places to work, right? I really loved it because no 2 days were the same. And there are lots of funny things that happen, right? So I went home, I was telling my dad all about this thing, and this funny thing happened. And then, so I did this. And really what I wanted to do was for him just to enjoy the joke and the lightness of what I was telling him. But what he did was he turned around and told me what I should have done differently, because that would have been better. I would have had, and actually that wasn't the point of what I was saying to him. So this is what I mean. Focus on connection rather than correction.
Yeah, lovely, lovely. That's really constructive, easy advice for us parents to follow. And it really kind of, it will elicit that feeling that we're trying to generate of affirmation and just valuing neurodivergent children for what they are, which is great. Karen, that's brilliant. Really, really helpful. Any last thoughts before we wrap up for today on how to navigate your children and how to help them avoid coercive relationships, apart from building confidence? And you know what? It's beautifully simple. If making them understand that they are valued and loved exactly as they are, and that they have huge value to bring to our world. It's great. I mean, it's really, it's so positive and constructive, and it's helful as well.
Yeah, I think the other thing I'm a great believer in dropping seeds or asking questions that are clearly not in the mind of the person I'm talking to, but that should be, that they should be asking themselves, but not requiring an answer. So, you know, if I thought, for instance, my child was involved in something that felt like not particularly safe to me, one tack I could have would be to ground them and, you know, not never let them out of my sight and, you know, end up with a child that's running away or, you know, breaking things in my home or whatever. Or I might just say something like, oh, you know, I wonder how easy it would be to remain friends if you weren't doing that stuff with them. Now, commonly what happens is they might want the conversation with that. Actually, they may have been looking for an in for a conversation with me about that, right? So number one, I have to look in their eyes and see, are they engaging with it or not? If they are, then they'll say something and I can continue and maybe help them out. If not, I'm very lucky in that I'm 60 years old. I have a middle, you know, a bladder that needs relieving quite often. So I normally just go, oh, really sorry, I need the loo. And I go to the toilet because I don't need them to have a conversation with me. I just need them to think about that question, right? And at another time, they'll either come to me or they'll suddenly come to me and go, oh, yeah, you know, actually, they were really nasty when I mentioned this about, you know, whatever to them. So all I would say is dropping seeds is fantastic. Don't expect an interaction. and provide a way for the interaction to not happen without it feeling weird. And needing the toilet is a really good way to just leave a situation all of a sudden. Because by the time I've come out, they've got bored and wandered off, you know, and we just get on with our day. So,
brilliant. Thanks a million, Karen. Now I'm going to lower the level right down. Are you watching Traitors?
No. Is it good?
Well, no, the reason why I'm asking is because one of the people in the show has autism.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And I'd love your take on it. So that's your task for the next show. You have to watch Traitors and tell me what you think. For me, it's very, very positive because he clearly explains that he has autism, and he explains how he feels in different situations. I think it's a lovely way, because obviously we all know mainstream media is a great way of getting people to put themselves in each other's shoes, and it shines a lot. You know,
I haven't seen it, but I will have a watch, and I agree. I think representation, that people can, where people can connect with a person within that community and see their real life, is always a winner. And in that same token, I've just finished watching the Portrait Artist of the Year. And the winner of that is a young trans man. And that for me, that's about how do people understand the trans lifestyle, the trans way of being, and move away from the terrible rhetorics that sometimes come with people who don't understand, you know, that community. So again, I think anywhere where you can get representation of a minority, particularly a very misunderstood one, that shows the positivity and the value that this community bring to all of us is a win for me. So yeah, I'll have a look. You know, I've avoided it because I just get this feeling there's a lot of tension.
Yeah, I get
and
it.
I can't
there
manage
is
a lot of tension. So yeah, so yeah. I'll do my best.
I have to say I'm the same. I don't like conflict, and that was my concern about watching it. But there are some shows that provide good all family viewing, something that we can all sit down and watch together. And there was a consensus to watch Jess, so I kind of I fell in behind. But actually, it isn't giving me that knot in my stomach.
Okay,
that
I'll
thought it.
Then I'll give it a go, and I'll let you know.
Let me know, because I'd like to know what the pros and cons of representation in this case are. But anyway, listen, it's just been so lovely talking to you as always, Karen. Thanks a million for coming on the show.
Oh, it's always a blessing to be here, so thanks very much for having me.
It's all our pleasure. Talk to you soon, Karen.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.